Sibelius's final symphony is seventh, the concentrated essence of all he'd been trying to achieve as a symphonist, encapsulated in a single movement performed here in the Royal Albert Hall to end the first half of the Prom live on Radio 3, the home of the BBC Proms, by the Halle Orchestra and its music director, Mark Elder. Vaughan Williams was the man who said there weren't many composers who could sound so fresh in C major. And Sibelius said in the early stages of writing it, the seventh was full of the joy of life. Mind you, he struggled with it over several years, riven with the doubts which made writing music progressively more difficult, which finally caused him to destroy his eighth after many years' work on it. Back comes Mark Elder onto the platform, rejoining the Halle. And bringing Gary McPhee, principal trombone, to his feet. Quite a brass-heavy programme tonight, the entire wind section. And the trumpets, who will have a lot more to do in the second half. And the horns. You can hear the Sixth Symphony on Monday, August the 8th, an all-Scandinavian programme, Royal Stockholm Philharmonic with their chief conductor, Sakari Oromo. It's paired with Nielsen's fourth inextinguishable, the Greek piano concerto, Alice Sara Ott as soloist. The entire Halle on its feet, Mark Elder in the middle of them. Well, after the interval, the Halle and Mark Elder performed two more late works, ending with Janáček's Sinfonietta, his glorious celebration of the miracle of liberty of the independent Czechoslovakia after the First World War. Before that, the last completed work, well, almost completed, of Béla Bartók, his third piano concerto, which tonight soloist András Schiff describes as a wise man's farewell full of resignation. But for the next 20 minutes, we head down the steps to the Royal College of Music, where we find Louise Fryer, and we've the chance to find out more about how Bartók, the man and musician, arrived at this extraordinary swan song.
Tonight, András Schiff will be joining the Halle to play Bartók's Piano Concerto No. 3. And with me to discuss that piece and Bartók's life and music more generally are the musicologist and writer of a number of books on Bartók, Malcolm Gillis, and the Hungarian poet and translator, George Surtees. Thank you very much for joining me. Malcolm, in the introduction to your book, Bartók Remembered, you say that people recalled Bartók as small and tall, as dour and with a sense of humour, as chubby and frail. Now, we all present different aspects of ourselves, I suppose, depending on the audience we're addressing, but why do you think Bartók is so hard to get a clear impression of?
Maybe he was a complex man. Maybe the people who saw him looked on him from their perspective. To the Americans, he looked small. To the Hungarians, he was quite average height. He was chubby when he was younger, but he was quite frail in his last years.
So he had a number of episodes throughout his life that took him in very different directions. But he was very much a Hungarian. He was one of the well-known Hungarian composers, together with Liszt and Kodály and Dohnányi. George, to what extent was their music typically Hungarian?
Well, that depends on who you ask, I think. And it depends what Bartók might have said about that. I think the Hungarian in the street would think that Bartók was a major composer of some difficulty who had something to do with them. But they wouldn't be absolutely certain. What they know, I think, this is to say ordinary people, they would know the Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsodies, they'd know the Brahms' Hungarian dances, and they would think of that as Hungarian. But the degree to which Bartók himself plumbed some aspect of Hungarianness is fascinating, and as Malcolm says, that too is quite a complex issue.
Is that because Hungary itself has had quite a turbulent history?
Well, yes, it's very difficult to say what Hungary is. I mean, Hungary, as you see it on a map now, is about one-third of the size of Hungary as it was before the end of the First World War. But if you go back even further, it was thinner, smaller, bigger. And because of its varying size and because the whole region is full of very flexible borders, different pockets of population become included within the political entity. So there are always questions, I mean even quite current questions, they're always current actually, come to think of it, as to what is Hungarian, what is it to be Hungarian, who represents us as Hungarians.
Malcolm, how do you think Bartók thought of himself in terms of nationality? What rooted him in Hungary?
He's a very intelligent man and a very cultured man. He went through many phases, but was always a Hungarian. He saw himself as being a patriotic Hungarian in the latter part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The First World War and what came after that left him somewhat disillusioned, and he started to move towards a view that there was a Danube nation's integrity that grew in the 1930s to his belief in what he called a brotherhood of man. And he, in fact, was on one of the committees of the League of Nations. And then the Second World War came, and he thought, I might be Hungarian, but I don't know if it's safe to stay here, and went to America and so became an exile. So he died still a Hungarian, but in exile, and not quite sure whether he should go back or not, even though he died just after the end of the war.
It's worth picking that up, because where Bartók was born was no longer Hungary. By the time he came to maturity, where Bartók's mother lived was no longer Hungary by the time that Bartók came to maturity. So to some degree, Bartók was an exile from the very beginning. That is to say, the region which he wanted to explore, particularly in music, lay partly in Hungary, but partly outside it.
So he went out into the countryside to collect music of Hungarian peasants. It was something that he took very seriously, didn't he?
Well, Hungarian peasants, but also Romanian and Slovak. In fact, he collected more Romanian songs than he collected Hungarian songs, but they were Romanians living within what was then the Hungarian part of the dual empire. So it gets confusing, and Bartók's most popular piece of all, called Romanian Folk Dances, that I'm sure many in the audience have played, was originally called Romanian Folk Dances from Hungary.
But he would take a gramophone out with him, he would stay in villages for several days or even weeks at a time.
Yes, he said that his happiest days were those spent in villages recording songs, folk dances with the people. And there are some wonderful photographs of Bartók with this new thing called the gramophone, and these people who've never seen this machine before, all lined up as if it's a wedding or something, terribly excited about the prospect, for the first time in their life, of hearing their voice coming back. They'd never had that opportunity before. And it's the exciting event of the village year. So, and you can see Bartók so excited to be there and to capture those tunes before some of them disappeared in all time.
And he wasn't interested in just preserving them. He was also interested in seeing how they were used within the community. Is that right, George?
Well, yes, they were mostly used for feasts, for weddings, for the noble sort of ritual occasions, rites of passage, celebrations. I mean, it's part of a cultural whole. They weren't divorced. Music wasn't divorced from life. Music was very much part of life. It's interesting that perhaps I can refer to something that I've just been doing, which has been tracing up the music of gypsies or Roma in Hungary, and the role that music plays in their life, which is almost entirely to do with festivities, with celebrations. So they're part of the whole sense of life. They're part of dancing. They're part of as much as a church.
Now, we've picked up quite a bit on the theme of exile, and the piece that András Schiff is going to be playing tonight is the third piano concerto, which Bartók wrote in exile in America. How did that come about?
In the very last years of Bartók's life, he started to compose again. He'd had 3 or 4 years after he'd left Hungary and gone to the United States when he just felt he couldn't compose. Some people say it was because New York was just so noisy. And Bartók really treasured silence. But he found that inner equilibrium in the last couple of years and composed a concerto for orchestra that is one of his most famous works. and a solo violin sonata for Yehudi Menuhin. He realized that both of his piano concertos, and we're hearing both of them in this this prom series, were rather difficult works. In fact, hair-raising works. In fact, hugely difficult works that sometimes he himself couldn't quite play. So he thought, I must write something more accessible. In fact, why don't I write something for my second wife, Dieter Pastery, who's a very good pianist, so that she could have a piece that was for the smaller hands, one not quite so bristling with technical difficulties. And he did that, but just didn't quite finish orchestrating the last 17 bars of the work. So think of Bartók dying just a few seconds before the end of that piece tonight. He didn't actually orchestrate those final bars.
So he was ill while he was writing it, and he knew that he was ill, but did he know how serious the disease was that he was suffering from?
He did. And he was one of the first civilians in the United States to use penicillin, starting off in 1943, when it was still pretty much restricted to military or VIP use.
And he was helped, wasn't he, by the American Composers Society in terms of financial support and medical advice?
Yes, absolutely. It would have been very difficult for him to have survived without that support. But he was a very proud man, and he was very concerned that he wasn't able to pay it back. So for him, it wasn't something that eased him. He fretted about the fact that he was now indebted to people. He wasn't even a member of ASCAP. In fact, I think I'm correct in saying he wasn't allowed to be a member of ASCAP because of their rules on foreign citizenship, or maybe because he was classified as an enemy alien in the United States.
And how was his third piano concerto received, George, in America and at home in Hungary?
It's very popular in Hungary. It's one of his more popular pieces, I think, isn't it? It sings more. It has more melodies that people would faintly recognize. There are, I suppose, quite nostalgic references to themes that would be familiar to people, or at least as familiar as they would be through Bartók of Hungarian music. It's interesting that the general concern with folk music and its importance in Hungarian culture has received quite a lot of attention over that, especially since the 70s or 80s, I think. So in a way, there's a sort of weaving back of Bartók into a folk tradition.
And immediately after it was first performed by Georges Sandor, I think, how did people respond to it then? Was his music acceptable in Hungary after the war?
Well, that is another complicated story, and I'm sure Malcolm would have more to say about that. People who went abroad during the war weren't necessarily welcomed back after the war. In any case, the regime in Hungary was changing, so some of Bartók's works would have been regarded as being abstract and formalist. And there was this charge which they used to use called bourgeois individualism, which came about 1949. Between 45 and 49, I'm not sure, you'd have to ask Malcolm as to how it was really received.
Well, I think because Hungary was moving towards being communist during those years, you still had a lot of playing of Bartók's works, including the most radical ones. But from 1950 to 55, under a fairly strict doctrine of socialist realism, very much as Shostakovich was suffering from after 1948 in the Soviet Union, you had different lists. You had the list of banned works. The two early piano concertos were banned because they were formalist and they were dissonant and they weren't celebrating the heroic sense of the people. And the third piano concerto, however, was tuneful, like the concerto for orchestra, almost like song symphonies or concertos, and so they were allowed. The only ideological problem was they were the ones that were written in America, while the ones they banned were the ones that were actually written in Hungary. So it was rather confusing to people as the CIA was, through Radio Free America, broadcasting lots of Bartók into Hungary.
Do you think he was writing the third piano concerto for an American audience, or for himself, for his wife, for a Hungarian audience?
My guess would be for himself. I don't know how far, Malcolm will tell you more about this, how far he tried to adapt himself to where he was. I think people of that age find it very, very hard I think at a Hungarian photographer, Andrei Kertész, whose work is currently on at the Royal Academy, who arrives in New York and cannot adjust. And in a way, he has to recompose himself. It seems to me that Third Piano Concerto to be a work of longing and a kind of passion beating against. It feels to me quite a self-reflective work in a way. It's kind of what's missing.
Does that say that in the American years, Bartok had a number of forces on him? One of them was he was very short of money. And if he had a commission, he wanted to make sure it was definitely played and received. And so the Concerto for Orchestra, I think, is a work that is setting out to be popular. In fact, in some regards, and when you know it well, he's actually sending up a lot of things, very subtly sending up Shostakovich. He's sending up popular music. He's sending up the tradition of the orchestra by having these play of pairs in the second movement. And that's nice, but you can just hear it naively as being a work that has got an American tinge to it. And by the time of the Third Piano Concerto, he wants it to be a work that would be played, that hopefully his wife could earn money for when he was dead. And so in many regards, it is that passing on of an inheritance to his second wife. So he didn't want to make it too bristling with difficulties. Not too many orchestras like the New York Philharmonic that wouldn't be able to play it at the premiere, as happened in New York with the First Piano Concerto.
And in America itself, Bartok suddenly became much more popular after his death, which seems tragic.
Well, I think that's because you do really have a Hungarian mafia of great musicians. And you had dozens of them, most of them exiles, and they took Bartok's music around the world. In fact, so many of them were the students of either Kodály or Dohnányi or Bartok that they felt a personal sense of allegiance when Bartok died to spread the word, and they did.
Now, András Schiff is performing tonight. He, in a sense, could also be considered an émigré. Does that feed into his performance, do you think, as we're listening to that? Is that something to bear in mind?
I think it's useful to bear in mind. I mean, Bartok is, I suppose, to a great degree a political émigré, and Hungary has a history of political emigration, and you have to go back to 1890s, to the 1919s. There are constant periods in which people are going abroad, staying abroad for a while in some cases, and then returning. I think the case with Schiff, who has had homes abroad in any case, I believe, in Florence and in London, he was disturbed by some of the political changes that were happening in Hungary, and he wrote about that in a letter at the beginning of the year when Hungary acceded to the presidency of the European Union. On the basis of which he was furiously attacked, and I believe it is said that he was threatened too. And so he said he would not return. He would not return to live there. So essentially he is regarding himself, I imagine, as an exile and a feeling for exile. I mean, it arrives to different people in different ways, I guess. To somebody like Schiff, it would have arrived painfully and suddenly and as a violent intrusion, I think, into his life. And I think some of that may be available in a performance.
You yourself left Hungary when you were still a child. Do you feel as though you're an émigré?
It becomes more complicated as you get older, funnily enough. When I was a kid, I didn't think so at all. I just thought it was an English kid going to an English school. Albeit people said, you have a funny accent, and I still have an accent, maybe less funny. But yeah, you work your way into a sort of society. There's a history of Hungarian assimilation. One of the things you will not find in England is a Hungarian ghetto or a Hungarian area of London, for example. So there is this will and desire to assimilate. There are all kinds of possible reasons for it, including language. But as time goes on, not so much for me, but I think I notice it particularly in my parents, and particularly in my mother, who as time went on was culturally cast adrift, which also means that you're psychologically, to some degree, cast adrift. Well, I'm a writer, I write in English, not in Hungarian, and so I have the comforts and the scope to be able to, if you like, to give voice to such things insofar as they appear, whereas to somebody of her generation with her lately learned English, I think that was much more difficult.
Is there something for an artist that determines which direction they take? As an émigré, is it easier somehow to use words or to use music to express your feelings of loss?
There's a lot of interesting things said about this. And it's true, you take people like Nabokov, you know, great writer writing in his second language. There's a sense in which you could argue, and it's very hard to argue in one's own case, because you're inside yourself and you don't know, that the language which then you take on has a kind of exotica, an exotic flavor to it, and that it is precious and odd, and that that may in some respects be an advantage, that is when it's not being a disadvantage. So, but it means that phrases just strike you with a certain precision and clarity because they do seem new. It's not something which you've kind of lived with from the very, very beginning.
I suppose, Malcolm, it's possible to think of Bartók as being an outsider right from the beginning. He was quite sickly as a child, wasn't he, and was kept apart from other people. Did that affect the way he grew up and his whole character?
I'm sure it did, and it left him very dependent upon his mother because his father died when Bartók was very young, age 5 or 6. But as well as that, you've got someone training to be a musician in a series of country towns, knowing from an early age that he had a special musical talent. And as his mother moved from town to town seeking work as a teacher, and that was difficult in the 1890s, I think Bartók was quite dislocated. And so by having gone to 5 or 6 different schools, he did find it harder to make friends, but then became very self-contained, very, very tough. He had some further illnesses when he was in his late teens and had to have a term off at the Liszt Academy, as it then became. And I think that further caused him to draw on inner resource and become absolutely determined to succeed.
Are we still slightly frightened of Bartók? Is that one of the problems? We're familiar maybe with the string quartets, which are a bit spiky and we're not quite sure about them. And then we're so surprised when we hear the later works.
Well, if I could modestly suggest something there. I think we're now going through a big change in Bartók reception because those who knew Bartók have essentially died. We've lost the connection directly with those who knew him well or were performing associates. So we now just have to get on by ourselves. And what we're doing in rediscovering Bartók's music now, having severed that direct link, I mean, Gyöngy Scholti was one of the last people who had one of those strong links there, or György Sándor, you're in the position of saying, well, what does it sound like? And people suddenly think, well, you know, compared with what else has been written in the last 80 or 100 years, it's not so bad at all. In fact, maybe we are the ones who are mad, and maybe Bartók was always sane.
Well, that sounds like a good place to end. So it just remains for me to thank my two guests, George Surtees and Malcolm Gillis, and thank you too very much for coming.
Louise Fryer at the Royal College of Music. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley. The second half of this prom being given by the Halle Orchestra with its music director, Mark Elder, and as every concert in the season is, live on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. The Halle ends with one of the great pieces of orchestral exhilaration, Janáček's Portrait of Liberty, his Sinfonietta. But during the interval, the Albert Hall stage has acquired a piano, the reason for that being Bartók's third piano concerto played tonight by András Schiff.
I know very well Bartók's piano playing. Luckily, he left a lot of recordings and he was a magnificent pianist. And those recordings are invaluable because, to me, it's not just the best way to play Bartók, but the only way. Musical notation, as we see it on the printed score, it's very beautiful, but it's not a perfect way. There is no better way. But luckily, we know how Bartók played, and there is a rhetoric, a speaking element in the way he plays, and I want to convey that. I think we know very well what he wanted.
Bartók fled from the fascist-oriented Hungary, spent the last 5 years of his life in the United States, where he struggled to make an impression. His health was fragile, money was scarce, and he pined for home. He was diagnosed with leukemia in the summer of 1945. The terminally ill composer wrote his third piano concerto for his wife, Ditta, to try to give her something that would guarantee her concert bookings after his death. Lynn Fletcher makes her way over to the piano, leader of the Halle. Tentative, eh, I'd say. Well, the music is mellower in this concerto than in the two earlier piano concertos. Two more brilliant movements, you could say, enclosing a calm, soothing, slow central one. Bartók marked it Adagio Religioso. The music seems to refer to the Hymn of Thanks in Beethoven's A minor string quartet, which he wrote when he recovered from illness. Bartók, too, went briefly into remission at this time, was grateful he could work again. The Beethoven Allusions, followed by one of Bartók's most evocative pieces of night music with birds whose songs he'd notated in North Carolina. And then Bartók invokes Bach, the other authority in his aesthetic world. The finale begins with a reference to Bartók's twin inspiration besides nature, folk music, pounding dance rhythms with their stress on the first note, reflecting the way Hungarian always stresses the first syllable of a word. But the piano writing throughout is less percussive and driven than in the two earlier piano concertos, surely because for the only time in his life, Bartók wasn't writing piano music for himself to play. And now here comes András Schiff, followed by Mark Elder, joining the Halle Orchestra to perform Bartók's third piano concerto. Thank you. The dance of life still dominant in Bartók's music, even if the composer himself was dying. His last just about completed work, the third piano concerto, played here in the Royal Albert Hall by András Schiff with the Halle Orchestra, conducted by Mark Elder. Very, really contained figure at the piano, András Schiff. Great shock of white hair. Flamboyant occasionally at the end of a passage, but actually very contained, and very light touch, which is exactly what Bartók himself had. If you heard András talking beforehand about how Bartók played, even if this concerto was written for Bartók's wife to play after his death. Mark Elder and András Schiff back on the platform. Mark Elder allowing András Schiff to take the whole limelight. Schiff's Tommy, he stayed in a cottage in the woods of Vermont, and he woke up to exactly the same birds that Bartók notates in the slow movement of that concerto. And he does say that he feels the slow movement is a metamorphosis, a renunciation by Bartók when close to death of that atheism that he'd said was absolutely firm right the way through from his teenage years. Bartók wrote the concerto away from the hated city. In this case, it was New York, on the shores of Lake Saranac. Hated cities because he felt cut off from nature. And he said that nighttime on the great Hungarian plain with the sounds of birds and insects inspired in him something close to religious feeling. Back onto the platform comes András Schiff. Just as focused, just as listenable too in Bartók piano concertos as he is, say, when he's accompanying Lieder. Had the good fortune to hear him accompanying Angelika Kirchschlager recently. Extraordinary musicianship this man has. Well, as I said, all three Bartók concertos this season. Jean-F. Lambabuse plays the first on next Tuesday, the 26th of July, London Philharmonic and Vladimir Yurovsky. All Hungarian programme, Kodály's Dances of Galanta, Liszt Faust Symphony, and some more. Andras Schiff's encore, a little magical slip of a piece, the Hungarian melody in B minor of Schubert, based on a folk song he heard when he was teaching the two daughters of Count Esterházy one summer in Hungary. That comes Andras Schiff, running onto the stage. Got a bit of a holiday now before he goes off to play at the Salzburg Festival. Deep low bow to a very appreciative audience here in the Royal Albert Hall, and bowing in thanks to the Halle. Well, the piano will be moved away now, so the stage here in the Royal Albert Hall can accommodate quite a few more musicians, particularly brass players, and especially the 12 trumpets Janáček asks for in his Sinfonietta, his last symphonic work. Well, at rehearsal earlier, I asked Mark Elder what relationship he saw between the music of Bartók and Janáček.
Both Bartók and Janáček spent an enormous amount of time trying to find a way to reflect the inflections of their languages, and how the folk music in their great countries could inform a musical language. Their two countries, Moravia and Hungary. And they solved the problems in very different ways. But there is, as a result, an earthiness in their music that I enjoy so very much and is so valuable. There's something so grounded in these composers.
Can you describe the way Janáček uses the orchestra? I mean, it's very personal. It's kind of unidiomatic, at least when it comes to string writing.
He had a voice inside him all his life that was gritty, that was rhythmically very propelled, that had little folk song cells, often, as the basis of his music. This applies as much to his theatrical music as to his non-theatrical. And he liked writing in strange keys. A-flat minor was unquestionably his favourite key. No one else's, be it said. And the writing uses the extremes of the instrument's range and the sonorities of his music, so daunting when one first hears them, are so imaginative, original and thrilling to me. The sound of those snarling trombones at the beginning of the second movement, the sound in the third movement of the piccolos and flutes, screaming in terror, as we are asked to remember what the Queen's Monastery was used for, not for spiritual contemplation, which of course is what he remembered it as being, because he sang there as a boy, I think, in the choir, didn't he?
Mark Elder, well, the Sinfonietta is a remarkable example of the immense creative energy that filled Janáček at the end of his career. Success had come late to him. He was in his early 60s before his opera Jenufa was a huge success in Vienna during the First World War. 2 years later, his artistic liberation from obscurity was joined by a feeling of personal liberation with the end of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. He felt that his home city of Brno was transformed in front of his eyes. For instance, the hated Spielberg Castle, which had a notorious dungeon where the Habsburgs held political prisoners, lost its aura of terror as a prison. One sunny summer's day, 7 years after the birth of the new free Czechoslovakia, the 72-year-old composer was sitting in a park with the young Kamila Sturzlova, his muse for the last decade of his life. They were listening to a military band concert. Janáček was much taken with some fanfares they played and incorporated them soon afterwards into his Sinfonietta. He explained how the music of the piece described his feelings about Brno after his country won independence. I saw the town undergo a miraculous change. I lost my aversion for the gloomy town hall, my hatred for the hill from whose depths so much pain was screaming, my distaste for the street and what was crawling in it. As if by a miracle, the sheen of liberty spread, shining over the town. I belong to this resurrection, and the blare of the victorious trumpets, the shadows of night, the breath of the green hill, the vision of the growing greatness of the town of my Brno were all giving birth to my Sinfonietta. The musicians to play that Sinfonietta are now all safely ensconced on the stage, with right at the back, high up on the platform, the trumpets, the extra trumpets, two bass trumpets, two tenor tubas, right high up, right next to the bust of Sir Henry Wood, and just in the lee under the organ. And normal brass section on the other side of the stage. Mark Elder rehearsed this very thoroughly earlier today, and here he is back on the platform to conduct the Halle in Janáček's Sinfonietta.
Thank you.
Janáček's Sinfonietta, which he said expressed the contemporary free man, his spiritual beauty and joy, his strength, courage and determination to fight for victory. It's been performed here at the Royal Albert Hall to end tonight's prom live on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, by the Halle Orchestra, led by Lynn Fletcher, conducted by its music director, Sir Mark Elder. Conducting baton list tonight, real fluidity. That was his word, not mine. He thinks that that's what it brings him. Decide sometimes with a baton, sometimes without. Tonight, it was without. Even with all those trumpets, tenor tubas, bass trumpets, all standing up, like by the bust of Sir Henry, for the opening and closing of that piece. Originally intended those fanfares for a gymnastic festival, quite heavily scored for such a graceful event. And the orchestral brass, not the extras, being brought to their feet by Mark Elder. And the wind. Next year, this lot will be playing their first Beethoven cycle for many years, chronologically during the season. Elder, Van Steen, Edward Gardner, the violinist Nikolai Snyder conducting the Ninth Symphony. That should be fascinating. And that big cheer, that's for the nine trumpets, the two bass trumpets, and the two tenor tubas. Wonder how many of them will be playing in the pit, because the Halle Orchestra finally going into the pit at the Lowry Theatre in Manchester to perform Bernstein's Wonderful Town, which Mark himself will be conducting. He's off to the Far East, South Korea and China, and Tannhäuser at the Paris Bastille in October. If you want to listen to this concert again, or you missed some of it, you can catch it again for a week, of course, or indeed this coming Sunday afternoon at 2 PM here on Radio 3. Tomorrow evening's BBC Prom, well, that gives you the chance to compare and contrast the Halle with Manchester's other orchestra, the BBC Philharmonic, as its chief conductor designate, Juanjo Mena, makes his Prom's debut. Mena, born in the Basque Country, his programme hovers deliciously between France and Spain. He produces images interspersed with evocations of Spain, Ravel and De Falla, his Nights in the Gardens of Spain, the piano soloist Stephen Osborne. Well, those are tomorrow's Prom's delights, live here on Radio 3. But as Mark Elder returns to the stage, brings the Halle to its feet, time for me to hand you on to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Martin, thank you very much. Martin Handley there at the Royal Albert Hall. And as Martin was saying, there's another chance to hear this evening's first Prom this Sunday at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. Well, back to this evening, and in 10 minutes or so tonight, our feature, Myths and Mystery Cycles, John Sessions, explores a research project rewriting the story of early English drama. That's at 10 o'clock. Until then, staying with Janáček, this is one of his male voice choruses, not perhaps of a familiar sight to him outside Czech lands. We heard a couple of them after the Janáček Glagolitic Mass in the first night of the Proms. This chorus tells the sad tale of Marička Magdonova, the orphaned daughter of a miner, her father murdered by comrades and her mother crushed by a coal wagon. Marička's left to look after her younger brothers and sisters, but is caught by the police while out gathering wood on the estate of a German landlord. And rather than face the shame of a public trial, she throws herself into the river Ostrovice, the word Ostrovice, much repeated towards the end of the song. The singers at the premiere in 1908 were the self-same choir, same in name anyway, as sing on this 1970 recording of it, the Moravian Teachers Choir. Music by Janáček, his male voice chorus, Marička Magdanova. It's alternating double and quintuple rhythms, generating a very free declamatory manner whose flow seems to express perfectly the narration of a very beautiful and very tragic song. And its challenges holding no terrors for the performers there. The Moravian Teachers Choir, conducted by Antonín Tuchapský, a recording from 1970, that particular song, Janáček, dedicated to the Moravian Teachers Choir, so perhaps it shouldn't be surprising the authenticity of both style and feeling is as strong as it is.
From the BBC Proms, principal conductor Sir Roger Norrington bids farewell to the Stuttgart Radio Symphony Orchestra, and a post he's held since 1998. On BBC Radio 3, live from the Royal Albert Hall, you can hear one of Norrington's final performances with his orchestra and one of the greatest of all late Romantic symphonies, Mahler's Symphony No. 9, live from the BBC Proms, Monday night at 7:30.
This is BBC Radio 3, it's 10 o'clock, and now on Radio 3, the actor John Sessions turns medieval archivist as he discovers the scale and detail of a research project that's redefining the story of our theatrical heritage. He begins his exploration of the myths and mysteries of our dramatic past alongside Professor David Klausner in the distinctly untheatrical setting of the Borthwick Library at the University of York, pawing over a dusty ledger. Myths and Mystery Cycles.
Rydale.
Yes, this is in the rural deanery of Rydale. So we've got 1, 2, 3, 4 entries here. The top one here says William Ure. They are accused that they have given monthly sermons in his default, being proprietary of the rectory there. And also, the choir door and windows want repair. This is probably church wardens who are being accused of not keeping the fabric of the church in good
repair. You're eavesdropping on a medieval scholar in full enthusiastic flow. Professor David Klausner is a Reed editor. Reed, standing for Records of Early English Drama. Now, bishops nagging church wardens over the upkeep of their choir doors may not seem the most auspicious place to start an exploration of the origins of the drama that matured and thrived in the reigns of Queen Elizabeth and King James I. But it's through the minute exploration of documents like this, and court records, council minutes, even, heaven forfend, account books, that we're learning an astonishing amount about the true nature of the artistic society in which Shakespeare flourished.
Coventry, 1573. Charges of the pageant. Paid to God, 3 shillings and 4 pence. Paid to the prologue, 8 pence. Paid 3 saved souls, 5 shillings. Paid for shutting the door, dressing the pageant and keeping the wind, 16 pence.
The books and papers the Reed editors examine don't include the few surviving play manuscripts that have dominated thinking on this subject for years. The so-called mystery cycles of York, Chester, and the one which now appears to be wrongly attributed to Wakefield, are hugely important. But they've misled us into a top-down view of the way English drama developed. Instead, the Reed army, and it is an army, is looking for any reference, any clue, that sheds light on the work and working lives of musicians, performers, and players. The research is being conducted county by county and occasionally, as in the cases of York, Cambridge, or Newcastle, city by city. Just how it's progressing, and has been for over 30 years, what impact the work has had on the study of our dramatic past, and why that should matter far beyond the cloistered world of medieval history and literature, is the theme and purpose of this programme. But it all begins here, in the archives. We're looking at the Visitation Court Book of 1615. David, can you tell me what this actually was?
The Archbishop of York, as all other bishops, did a regular visitation around the diocese, stopping in the various deaneries, essentially checking up on the morals of the inhabitants. This is the parish of Kirkdale, you can see up here, in Rydale.
Rydale, yeah.
Yes. The very first one here I ignored completely because it's got two names in it, Thomas and Miriam, and then you can see the Latin word fornicat with an abbreviation mark after it. Well, we know what that's all about. And
right.
That's of no interest to Reed whatever.
No, because Reed is a very virtuous
organization. Reed is, it is indeed. So we have absolutely no interest in village matters, as Hamlet would say.
Yes.
So,
rumpy pumpies.
Rumpy pumpies.
The Scots would say, yes.
Yes. The first process, of course, is going through the documents themselves, as that's what we've been doing here, and actually tracking down references that are important, that have something to do with, and the Reed mantra is drama, minstrelsy, and mimetic ceremony. The difficulty with it is if you ask, what does a Reed editor need to do in a particular locale, in the North Riding or in Wales or something like that? The real answer is you need to read all of the surviving documents prior to 1642. That's a warehouse full.
It's rather like, I don't know, prospecting for
zirconium.
Oh,
it is. No, that's exactly what it is.
You clearly are a very patient man.
John, you have to be. This volume is a rather good example. There are about 375 folios, so that translates to 750 pages in this volume.
So this would take you how long to work through?
I can do it in a day.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
You have to, though, and you have to start reading a volume like this knowing full well that it is entirely possible that you may read 750 pages and take a whole day or more over it, and you will not find a thing.
These documents are records of desire. The desires of the people who were involved in the plays, the desires of the sponsors, of those who funded them. And so you are getting directly rooted into the culture and the feelings of the time, even although you're dealing with dusty documents.
I think it's amazing that somebody took on a project to try to put together a map, and it really is a map, of the whole of arts activity in Britain across an enormous period of time up to 1642. To sustain that so far over 20-something volumes with 20-odd more to come, that is an astonishing scholarly achievement.
The situation 50 years ago, 60 years ago, was really as if we had the rules for rugby and a film of some people playing football. And the temptation would be to assume that they were playing by the same rules, and you would come to conclusions which are wholly irrelevant about who was winning and who was losing and what the hell they were doing. If, like me, you think context is absolutely vital for the meaning of a play at any moment, particularly at the royal court or in a noble household, then the Reed records are invaluable.
I can't account for why I'm still doing it, you know? It's endlessly fascinating. There are so many variations that it's constantly stimulating and challenging. But the biggest challenge for me now is to figure out how we can move this all online. And that's what I see as a really important purpose that we have.
The Canadian voice of Sally Beth McLean, the executive editor of Reed. I say Canadian because we should make it clear early on that this is a project centred upon, inspired and to a large extent funded by the University of Toronto. Before her, you heard the voices of Professor Peter Holland, Professor Greg Walker and another of the Reed editors, Professor John McGavin, who's gathering material from dusty Scottish documents, taking the project's ambition well beyond its original English boundaries. The key to this daunting enterprise is the vigilance of focus. Much of the reading of crudely written Middle English or Latin or even Welsh texts has to be discarded. The precious residue goes into the red volumes that make up the Reed collection.
Hereford, 1620. Acts of the Decanal Court. Proceedings of the court held in the Dean's Consistory of Hereford Cathedral before Master Jones. Anthony Wheeler, cleric, vicar there, was a spectator of such as danced before evening prayer on Sabbath days, that is, on 27th of August last. John Powell, for being the fiddler thereat.
I absolve you, John Powell, from the sour condemnation of your joyless puritanical judges. And that's the compelling thing about these records. Where you might anticipate pages of snore-inducing anonymous detail, real people emerge. And that creates another challenge for the editor. Who and how much should they include? Sally Beth McLean.
It is a constant debate. Just to go back to the very earliest days, there was certainly some pretty strong arguments in favor of including liturgical processions because Corpus Christi plays, as they were then called, were part of the processions outside the church. But we made a very definite decision that we were not going to be real, the records of early English liturgy. We were going to define the territory as secular drama, entertainment, mimetic entertainment in particular.
But with no religious mimetic overtones or undertones?
There are obviously religious undertones to the biblical play productions and some of the early saints' plays, for instance, yes. But liturgy itself in the churches we do not get into.
No.
And we don't include liturgical music.
Those decisions were crucial in ensuring that this would not be a process of adding further detail to our understanding of the highest echelons of religious and court society. Less bird and talus, more pipe and tabor, you might say. I was speaking to Sally Beth McLean at the annual Medieval Congress in Leeds, a rendezvous for people involved in and supporting the Reed Project. Professor Pamela King of Bristol University explained to me the history of the resurgent interest in early English drama.
There were antiquarians working out in the counties and in London who were aware of these records. But because nobody performed the plays, and the plays were thought to be scurrilous and blasphemous in all sorts of ways, it was difficult for them to understand what the records referred to in any meaningful way. It was also very difficult for them to have anybody pay attention to them. The London intellectual establishment simply dismissed their efforts, and it took a particular moment in the revival of interest in the plays, and particularly the revival in interest in the plays as heritage. Festival of Britain is possibly the great marker of that, to create an environment where people were reading them and wanted to know more about the context from which they came.
2 years after the 1951 Festival of Britain, the BBC made their contribution.
The BBC presents The First Stage, a chronicle of the development of English drama from the 10th to the 14th century. Arranged for broadcasting by John Barton and produced by Raymond Rakes.
We've already taken the story to the beginning of the 13th century, at which point English drama was beginning to be English and tending to become dramatic.
Along with the gentle wisdom of John Barton were the exuberant reworked versions of the medieval texts that remained from Chester or York or Coventry. Noah is brought to life here by none other than John Laurie, no doubt anticipating that mankind was doomed.
Have done, you men and women all. Hie you, lest the water fall, to work this ship, chamber and hall, as God hath bidden us do. Shame, my son.
Yea, father, I'm ready full soon. An axe have I by my crown, as sharp as any in all this town, for to go thereto. And here comes Brother Ham.
This labour is full great for an old man such as me. Lo, lo, how fast I sweat. It trickles about my ear. To home now will I wend, my weary bones for to rest. For such good as God hath sent, there get I of the best. To home now will I wend, I wend, to home now will I...
Dramatisations like this, full of earthy verve, albeit curtailed by 1950s primness, and books like E.M. W. Tillyard's The Elizabethan World Picture, were still touchstones when I was at university. The received view of our dramatic history was an evolutionary one. Liturgical dramas were born out of a desire to bridge the gap between churchmen and the non-Latin-speaking congregation. From thence they evolved, outgrew their church confines, and became miracle plays and mystery cycles, and it wasn't long before wandering players and minstrels, things of shreds and patches, started the journey that would lead to the theatres of London's South Bank. Hopelessly oversimplified, I know, but it serves to set the context in which the Reed Project was incubated.
I'm Alexandra Johnston, Professor Emeritus at the University of Toronto and founder and director of Records of Early English Drama.
Professor Johnston, known in Reed circles as Sandy, invited me to the museum in York, where the document that inspired the entire project is on temporary display.
I was working on my first sabbatical in the Library of York Minster. I was sitting at the table in the Minster Library one day when the then librarian, Bernard Barr, pitched a letter across the table to me, and I looked at it, and it was a transcription of the inventory of the Mercers, or Merchant Adventurers, of their pageant of judgment in the York Cycle. It's the only complete description of a pageant wagon in England that exists. It was a spectacular discovery.
This is the catalyst for the whole Reed enterprise. Can you talk us through what is going on in the document?
Okay, first of all, it's an indenture. You can see how it's cut at the top. The reason why they did that was there was two halves of the document. One half was kept by the company, one half was kept by the pageant masters. And it starts off by saying it's an indenture made in the Feast of Corpus Christi in the year of our Lord God, 1433. And then it describes, first of all, the pageant. They say pageant with four wheels, hellmouth, and then go into the costumes. Three garments for three devils and six devils' faces.
Three vezins or masks, array for two evil souls, that is to say two cirques or shirts, two pair of hose, two masks and two wigs, array for two good souls, two pairs of angel wings with iron in the end.
Iron in the end. And one of the neat things is that later we find the Mercers are renting angel wings from the Barkers, who did the first day of creation. Obviously, their wings were not particularly good.
This is no exquisite artifact. It's a working document, tightly written, discoloured, slightly frayed, and it had been hidden away in a solicitor's vault. It turned out that Professor Johnston wasn't alone in her discovery. Another scholar, Margaret Rogerson, was also homing in on the document that was to change both their lives. And from the very start, collaboration was the watchword.
I asked for her address and invited her to dinner, and in our youthful enthusiasm, decided we would do all the records of York and publish them together. And that's the document.
And this wasn't a mystery play as such, was it?
Well, it was part of the York cycle.
Right.
So it was a mystery play in that rather loose and now outmoded terminology. It was one of the biblical cycle performed in York, and this was the last judgment. This was the finale.
And why do you say outmoded?
Mystère comes from the French word for craft guild. That was used by scholars in the early 20th century. We no longer use that term because it's misleading. They were more than the possession of the craft, they were the possession of the city, they were probably written by clerics. We know a great deal more about them than the folk in the late 19th century who named them mystery plays.
How excited were you when you came across this?
Boy, they had to scrape me off the ceiling. Within the academic world, the buzz was huge. Margaret and I were invited to present that document at the Modern Language Association in New York the next Christmas. And then the Christmas after that, at the same conference, this time in Chicago, everybody said, we've got to have a big project to do this. And as I flew across frozen Lake Michigan on the way home from that conference, I conceived the idea of Reed, and 2 years later it happened.
What makes Sandy Johnston such a beguiling crusader, in a field which always runs the risk of being rather dry and distant, is her eye for the demotic, the details in the documents that speak of ordinary people at work.
You see those fold lines? That means that the pageant masters kept them folded up, and I like to think that the pageant masters had it in their belt because you can see how the ink has rubbed where it's been folded.
Abraded, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That guided the performance until they rebuilt the wagon in 1522.
As I was in York, I didn't want to miss an opportunity to see the Minster, which I've never seen. So here I am, looking up at the east window, well, the facsimile of the east window. You just see this bustling world, and it shouldn't surprise us that all the county records, which Reed so sedulously worked their way through, reflect that.
Herefordshire, 1358. Household accounts of Queen Isabella, widow of Edward. For John Monsores, a harper, while performing his minstrelsy before the Lady Queen at Hereford by gift of the same, on 9th July, 6 shillings and 8 pence.
I can show you one that came up this morning. Here's a pair of prosecutions of two gentlemen, both named George, for, and you can actually read it there because this is a very nice hand, for playing the sheriff at a rush bearing. And then the next one, for playing Robin Hood at the said rush-bearing.
Rush-bearing, could you just gloss that,
sure,
please?
The rush-bearing was a ceremony in which they would bring rushes into the church, put new rushes on the floor, decorate the walls of the church with rushes, so forth. In many cases, it was actually done as part of the church's patronal festival. So it would be on the feast day of the saint to whom the church has dedicated. Given that in this record the guy is playing the sheriff, this is already a Reed reference because he's doing something mimetic. He's creating a character. And the other one, the other George, who is playing Robin Hood, having actually spent about a week working on the North Riding, this is the first Robin Hood record I found. So I'm actually very pleased about this.
David Klausner. So Robin Hood plays, rush-bearing festivities, and plays telling the life of a parish patron saint were the norm, not a staple diet of mystery plays or cycles. That's the picture emerging from the fragments, confuting the evolutionary theory of English drama.
We know that Darwin has absolutely nothing to do with drama, and what we rather snidely call the evolutionary theory of English drama is a load of nonsense. There's all kinds of evidence for this. Liturgical drama, both within the liturgy and outside it, coexisted right through the whole of the Middle Ages. There was no kind of evolutionary development in which it left the liturgy because it got too big, or it left the church because it got too expensive. All of these things were actually taking place simultaneously.
What the Records of Early English Drama project has done is to provide a picture of a land where we have very few plays surviving, but one that was absolutely heaving with theatre, in which the York Cycle of Mystery Plays stands out as a remarkable oddity.
Pamela King again. My understanding of their argument is that the idea of the York or Chester cycles being typical would be like believing Wagner's Ring was typical of 19th century opera. The frustration for them will always be that they don't have the manuscripts for the equivalent of, let's say, Carmen or La Bohème. But this is why the Reed references that are being found are so valuable.
We know from those volumes of records from Kent that the villages around New Romney, on the marsh, all got together annually to put on a huge passion play. Here's another idiocy that I grew up with, which was that England had cycles of mystery plays, France had Passion. We had Passion. We've got some lovely things about the New Romney passion play, including the fact that we know who wrote the record. And we know, for example, that the Torturers of Christ come straight out of what we would have called the morality play tradition. They were called Mischance, False at Need, Untrust, Faint Heart, Unhap, Evil Grace. And beside the note that says Faint Heart is a little note that says, by me, Simon Padiham. So we also know that a guy called Simon Padiham, who played Faint Heart, wrote the record. Now that's the sort of thing that I get excited by. We're not bound by those few manuscripts in the British Library and the Bodleian, which 19th century editors found and edited, which have become canonical.
Old-time theatre scholarship was really driven by people who read plays and wanted to know something about them.
Professor Peter Holland, an independent voice on the subject.
Reed does it back to front. They have all this evidence of performance, and we don't know, for the most part, what the plays were that were being performed. But what they tell us about these plays is very different kinds of things. They tell us often that there was a great press of people at a play, so great that an iron bar that kept the door shut got bent and the city had to pay to have it repaired, so the record survives. They tell us about the frequency with which companies turn up in cities and towns. They tell us about where the players played. Not in inn yards, but in guild halls, even in churches, often playing in private houses, and also about amateur performances, so that we've got this sense of a kind of different way in which drama is permeating the culture. All the time we're used to thinking of it being driven by plays, but in fact there are lots of other kinds of events, like rush bearing and maypole dancing, a lot of public events. And everybody is making their own performance out of the richness of the world that they find around them. That's why one of the things I love are these ways in which they produce little local topical dramas. There was a great attack on a local worthy who was called Constable Hole, and you can imagine exactly what happened to his surname. What they're doing is something that we might call Chaucerian, as if they have to have the imagination of Chaucer to do it. But in fact, this is the very stuff out of which Chaucer makes the great stories that make up the Canterbury Tales.
Wells, 1607. Interrogatories for principal defendants in Hole versus White et al. Did you, about said 18th of June, ride astride in a red petticoat, kerchief and muffler, or some woman's apparel, about the streets in Wells, then holding a spinning wheel upon the horse before you and worsted wool upon a distaff, then turning the said wheel as you rode? Did you say as you so rode that it was Hole's wool, and then sang Hole, Hole, or words to that effect? And whose was the horse that you so rid upon? Speak the very truth upon your oath.
The case against Constable Hole's persecutor-in-chief, Edmund White, in 1607. This is the sort of material Reed executive editor Sally Beth MacLean hopes will enliven medieval and Elizabethan history for students and local historians once her website ambitions are realised, and it'll be freely available. But her greatest ambition is to rid the textbooks of the many myths about the medieval period and the drama and music that coloured it.
There's very little that's been found for in-yard performance, and that includes the Elizabethan era. People are taught to think that when the professional companies of London were forced onto the road with their pumps full of gravel, etc., that it was the plague that drove them out of the city, that normally they wouldn't choose to go to the provinces. But what we are finding, of course, is that they were going out to the provinces because they were welcomed by towns and gentry and nobility.
Yes, and
so they got bed and board when they went to the private residences. They had pretty nice indoor performance conditions there. And so what you have is a glimpse into what I think of as alternative theater, 21st century style. I mean, they had to be very adaptable to a wide variety of locations, but rather comfortable indoor locations, not out there in the beating sun or the pouring rain.
So very little evidence of let's do the play right here in the Inn Yard, although plenty of money being paid to players, performers and minstrels. And according to Elizabeth Baldwin, one of the editors for the Reed volume covering Chester, no simple across-the-board status for players and musicians.
You get at the top level the players who belong to livery companies and lords and the king's minstrels and things like that. But there's a certain downgrading, so you get the whole concept of the strolling minstrels. But at a parish level, they weren't actually strolling that far. And they were often men who had other professions as well, talking more about the musicians, who would be a tailor during the week, and then they go up and play the fiddle for parties on the weekend or on saints' days and things like that. You can say to students, look, there's someone here who was paid to play God or paid to set the world on fire.
Who was paid to set the world on fire?
It was Robert Crowe in Coventry, and he was capper, and he was writing or at least revising plays. He was also providing props. And in this particular play, which was Doomsday, he was paid to set the world on fire three times. So they evidently had a model of the world, and at the very end of Doomsday, up it went in smoke three times. One of the reasons we know that there were probably three performances of each pageant in Coventry in the 16th century.
And this is one of the really nice links between the records and the manuscript.
Pamela King again.
In the one surviving original manuscript of a Coventry pageant, Robert Crowe signs off at the end and says, this matter newly made by me, Robert Crowe, this day of March 1535. He's not a wonderful playwright, but he's a particular kind of theatrical person. And there are some lovely documents from the Leet, which was Coventry's city council from the same period, because it was a period of recession that these records survive from. Coventry, which famously made blue cloth, Coventry Blues, the football team, they couldn't get the alum to fix the woad, and so their single product economy went into decline. And some of the guilds were having difficulty sustaining their pageants. And the Leet wrote this long document, which is there in the Reed volume, that urges guilds to combine together, above all, to preserve the mystery plays for the unity and amity of the city.
The unity, concord and amity of all cities and commonalities. How refreshing is that as a summary of what drama can be? And there it is in a local government document of 1496. Is it too much to believe that their care for guild performances was rewarded by the Coventry Carol's survival to this day?
I'm going to have a go at reading this to see if I can read it.
Well, look at this second one. That's a good one to read, because that's something that we haven't seen before. So this is somebody by the name of John Beadle.
For not paying...
Yes.
For the something wage? Is that
wages?
Wages.
Yes. The clerk.
The clerk, yes, I see.
For not paying the clerk's... He's not paying his church tax.
Right.
A bit cheeky of me attempting to be a Reed editor for a day, but it was a quick way of discovering just how exacting the task is for David Klausner and his colleagues. And all this to be done when their teaching and other scholarship permit. Of course, for David and Elizabeth Baldwin, reading and locating the Reed references is only the beginning.
Once you've actually found the record, the first thing that I would do is to make a very exhaustive description of the manuscript in which it appears.
Transcribe it, order a photocopy from the record office.
Measure the pages, describe the binding. The critical reason for this is that it allows another researcher to come back and check my work if necessary.
And then somebody else in the Reed head office goes over the photocopy and the transcription and checks it very carefully. If there's anything that they can't read on the photocopy or they're not sure about or anything that's missing on the document description, they get someone on the spot, usually a part-time editor like me, to go and check again, but not the person who originally did it.
So someone can come back to the Borthwick Institute, he can go right to the volume that I've found, and since I have indicated which folio, that thing with the rush bearing, the sheriff and the Robin Hood on it, and I've indicated correctly which folio that's on, he will be able to turn instantly to that folio and check that reference.
And so everything that gets published in a Reed volume has been looked at by two professional editors.
There is light at the end of the tunnel. All of the areas of the British Isles are now in the process of being researched and edited. It's been very expensive. There have been at various times, I don't know, perhaps 40 or 50 editors working on the project, all funded from various research grants and so forth.
It's a very, very thorough process, and that's really why it takes 15 years to produce a volume.
The sense is we'd better get it right this time.
So, all that scholarship of the Reed editors, where does it all end up? Well, here we are in the University College of London Library. Serried rank of scarlet volumes. We've got, yes, Records of Early English Drama for Cambridge, Chester, Coventry, Devon, Herefordshire, Worcestershire, Lancashire.
Wells, the suit of John Hole, complainant. Did you with many others dance hand in hand in Wells till you came or danced near to the complainant's house and there whooped and hallooed and beat drums? And how many of them did go or dance there hence? Until you came to a tavern in the said town, and did you and your company thence continue dancing the long dance till you did meet the complainant? If yea...
You know, going back to something Peter Holland said, you know, I can really understand how you would lose all sense of time going through these volumes. I mean, you just get lost in these little worlds, these tantalising little tastes of performances, you know, improvised performances. One little detail leads to another. Here we go. King's Hall accounts, number 5. Likewise, sixpence for players on Christmas. Likewise, sixpence for dinner for the same on the same day. There we have it, a little sort of economic rundown of what these productions cost. And very nice to see the players getting paid properly.
One of the things we have to get used to, and that Reed is teaching us so much about, is that living outside London didn't mean that you didn't see great theatre.
Peter Holland, who believes the research already completed has helped clarify the context of the figure who is at the heart of any interest in the development of early English drama.
Take Stratford-upon-Avon, a tiny town of 2,000 inhabitants during Shakespeare's childhood. Here's the list of the companies that came to visit Stratford, some of them from London, some of them local, during that time. The Queen's Players, Worcester's Men, Leicester's Men, Warwick's Men, Lord Strange's Men, Essex Men, Lord Berkeley's Men, all across a 16-year period, and often coming back again and again. So major theatre companies were visiting small places like Stratford. It's as if in a small village now, you got a visit from the National Theatre, the Royal Shakespeare Company, and the Liverpool Everyman across a short period of time. That suggests a richness of an experience of drama in small locations that is far greater than anything we've got now.
Shakespeare has a currency around the world, and we are definitely making a difference to the understanding of Shakespearean era theatre and Shakespeare himself as a theatrical person.
From working at the Globe and looking at this extraordinary period, which Professor Andy Gurr termed the Shakespearean period, I think from 1576 with James Burbage building the theatre in Shoreditch to the closing of the theatres by the Puritans, there's a period there of remarkable expression of and growth of the English language.
My old RADA contemporary, and more importantly, one of our very finest actors, and the man who spent 10 years in charge of the Globe Theatre in London, Mark Rylance. I wanted to find out what impact the rediscoveries might have, not just on what we know of the past, but on how we might approach the drama of Professor Gore's Shakespearean period. For Mark, It's all about connections.
What's interesting is that for this period, you have the Renaissance, a European Renaissance, entering through the learned patrons. And in some cases, someone from a lower society like Marlowe moves up into that area of learning and is given a place at Cambridge and comes back and meets the players and is providing these fantastically skilled players with ideas and stories and conceptions of humanity that are new and are something different than just a Catholic or Protestant piece of propaganda or support. And that marriage of what's above and below is very important. And I think we have a narrow picture of what that marriage is about. I've always felt that at the top, the patronage and the influence from the people who are more learned and involved in the Renaissance is greater. And it's interesting to me to hear from what you're saying that what we're going to learn soon from the publication of this research is that the influence and skill of the players is also greater. Their flexibility, their ability to move between in a wide spectrum of drama was not relatively new, it was older.
Yes.
And that's a very important and good thing to learn. That adaptability and finding a vessel that can hold a serious and wonderful, beneficial content, that's always the issue for theatre. So to find out how our ancestors were doing this on the move and in the 1400s and 1500s is really helpful.
Mark Rylance. So, exemplary scholarship and research, myths exposed and insights offered to both academics and performers, and all soon to be available on the internet. Is there no fly in the medieval ointment? Peter Holland.
Whatever Reed does, it knows very well, and I think everybody involved in the project knows, it's only ever a kind of partial view. These are fragments of records. And all the time, what we run up against with Reed is that it cannot tell us many of the things we want to know. There are tens of thousands of records in Reed of performances of plays, and barely 100 where we know the title of the play that was performed. So we've got all this evidence of dramatic activity and no idea what it was actually doing. But at the same time, what I think it starts to tell us is to look a bit wider. And that gives us, I think, a richness to the texture of Elizabethan and Jacobean social life that we've never really known about before.
We will always have to use the caveat, it cannot be complete ever because we've lost so much. It's not just the manuscripts we've lost hordes of records. We always have to remind everybody that this never will be a complete picture in the way that no historical record is ever complete. We've been doing pretty well one volume, say 600 pages a year. If we're going to finish it in my lifetime, we're going to have to expand. And whether that is going to be possible entirely depends on the granting agencies.
Professor Sandy Johnston, with a tough if in these straitened times.
The idea of something which has a vision that might not be, let's speak it softly, completed in any of our lifetimes, and yet will be an invaluable resource for generations to come, is something that I think we're in danger of not being able to do for much longer unless we think very carefully about the infrastructure that sustains the kind of research that this project exemplifies.
Greg Walker.
The beginnings of regional drama, the beginnings are obscure, but the end point comes like a guillotine, 1642, well, when the Puritans came in. But I understand that during the protectorship of Oliver Cromwell, and briefly yes, Richard Cromwell, a lot of things slipped under the radar.
That's true. And that 1642 date, it's a notional date. You're absolutely right. And in fact, for the Wales volume, I made the argument to the editorial board that for Wales, the closing of the London theatres in 1642 was completely irrelevant. And they thought about it and said, yes, you're absolutely right, it is. What date would you like? So I said, well, let's go to the end of the protectorship, to the restoration, 1660.
Mm-hmm.
They said, okay.
And not beyond 1660 when Charles comes back, Charles II?
John, thereby madness lies.
Oh, yes, you were just, yes. And what happened when they said, right, North Riding's going for free, who's going to do it? Ah, Klausner's room.
That's precisely what happened.
I'll go, sir.
That's exactly what happened.
So you're like an RAF
hero. Well,
there was
a bit more to it in that I thought to myself, North Riding's a long way off from Wales. I don't know the North Riding at all. It'll get me somewhere where I've never really been. I love York, but I don't know the North Riding. Why not?
Professor David Klausner. It'll be a while before his work on the North Riding of Yorkshire and those two Georges involved in a rush bearing gets the editorial stamp of approval and completion. And while the website might be a cheap way of finding out about them, the printed red volumes come in at well over £100 a go. So the inevitable question is, is all this endeavour really worth it? Here's Scotland editor John McGavin, and before him, Professor Greg Walker.
I suppose one of the things that Records of Early English Drama does is join everything up. It joins the history of performance with the history of the theatre, with the history of literature, with the history of mentalities and the history of culture. This was a period when theatre, where drama, where performance and the reception of performance was central to what it meant to be human. It really is the history of everything on your shelf in a red book.
As we move into a global understanding of culture and we start hearing about local cosmopolitanisms all over the world, I think there's a reasonable case for saying it's about time we looked at our own local cultures, our regional cultures, our national cultures. I'm involved in it partly to give something back to the culture and the country which educated me and where I was born. I don't see why people in East Anglia or Cumberland and Westmorland should not want to know part of their heritage. Mm-hmm. People in London should not know part of their heritage. These are not things which are dead and gone. They're things which, when we pay attention to them, can give us a greater sense of our own identity now, a richer sense.
Professor John McGavin. And, truth be told, the Reed collection will never be a neat overview, nor will these volumes be consulted like a telephone directory. They're a contribution to a long scholarly process. And I feel genuinely enthused by my brush with it, not just for the lessons learned, or more accurately, the assumptions I've had to unlearn, nor for the generosity and professionalism of the people involved, although that has been a joy. What's really caught my imagination is the unfolding pageant of performers stretching back across the years before 1642. It's Simon Padiham from Kent, Robert Crowe of Coventry, and Edmund White of Wells, the tormentor of Constable Hole. Shakespeare, Marlowe, Webster, Kidd, Beaumont. The records of early English drama will have no impact on their reputations, but they will underline the importance of the context out of which and in which they thrived. And therein lies its relevance. Professor Peter Holland sums it up like this.
Our culture focuses too much on the top level of professional work, as if nothing important happens that doesn't happen at the National Theatre or the RSC or at Covent Garden or at the Festival Hall or whatever. But in fact, now there is a richness of theatre going on in every local community, and we don't really notice what's happening in the Am-Dram. But Reed tells us about early modern Am-Dram and medieval Am-Dram, and we're fascinated by it. So perhaps it'll teach us not to be quite so snobbish, not to be quite so metrocentric in what we think is really important in a culture. I love the stories that Reed tells me about the goings-on in small communities. And I think I also ought to pay attention to the goings-on dramatically in the communities in which I live.
Professor Peter Holland, ending this feature, Myths and Mysteries. The presenter was John Sessions, the producer Tom Alban, and the reader was Sam Dale.
Art revealed on the BBC.
For BBC Two, the art critic Valdemar Januszczak explores the Impressionists and their revolutionary techniques that changed art forever.
Brushes were the key to Impressionism. Without the latest brushes, applying the latest colours in the latest ways, Impressionism couldn't have happened.
New techniques that led to a new view of the world.
The Impressionists were trying to be true to life, to make everyday life a suitable subject for art.
The Impressionists continues this Saturday night at 8 o'clock on BBC Two.
You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's 10:45, and now we continue our series, Postcards from Istanbul, first broadcast last year to celebrate the city's year as a joint European capital of culture. Tonight's essay is by Elif Shafak, one of Turkey's best-selling writers, whose novel, The Bastard of Istanbul, was nominated for the Orange Prize. Istanbul is the city she calls home, and she thinks of it as a she city, or a city of women.
I came to Istanbul in my mid-20s. I think Istanbul has a call. She calls people from all over the world. Some people hear this call, some people perhaps don't. But at the same time, I've always had a very nomadic life. So usually what I like to do is to keep one foot here in Istanbul and the other foot in other places. Actually, there's a metaphor used by Rumi. He talks about a drawing compass. You know, one leg of the drawing compass is static. It is rooted in a place, in a certain spot. And in the meantime, the other leg draws a huge white circle around the first one. Just like that, I think my fiction is very much rooted in Istanbul. I have one leg here, but the other leg, the other part of my fiction, draws a huge white circle around the world. I write fiction in two languages, in both English and Turkish. When I look at the world and world literature, there have been many writers writing in more than one language. So I guess I like to commute between languages the way I like to commute between cultures. The city has always played a very important role in my writing, and I've never thought of her as a background, as an urban landscape. In my novels, Istanbul is always a very active, important character, and always a she character. Istanbul is like a huge, colorful matryoshka. You open it and find another doll inside. You open that only to see a new doll nesting, and so on and so forth. Istanbul is a multitude of cities hidden inside a single one. It's a labyrinth, a riddle whose solution is a further riddle. It's a hall of mirrors where nothing is quite what it seems. What looks very Eastern to an outsider might in fact have once been considered a Western symbol. Likewise, what at first glance looks old might be relatively new. One should be cautious when using categories to talk about Istanbul. If there's one thing the city doesn't like, it's clichés. This applies in particular to the labels East and West. The moment you use them with reference to Istanbul, they get evasive, almost slippery. Istanbul has multiple identities, and out of these, it creates new versions of itself. Where does this city, which straddles Asia and Europe, exactly belong? To the Orient or to the Occident? Istanbul is the most eastern of all Western cities, and the most Western of all metropolitan centers in the Middle East. It is a European capital of culture and art, and of yet-to-be-discovered tales. East and West are inextricably bound. However, we tend to ignore this and use these concepts as if they were mutually exclusive, like day and night. Their definitions are open to interpretation, and yet we regard them as static, if not eternal. But if you spend enough time in Istanbul, you learn to be wary of such labels.